Blog Talk Radio.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
I know you're asking today, how long will it take? Somebody's asking, how long will prejudice blind the visions of men? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment,
yes, sir,
however frustrating the hour, it will not be long, because truth crushed earth will rise again.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long?
Because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long?
How long?
Not long.
How long?
Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne.
Yes, sir.
Yes, that scaffold sways the future.
Yes.
Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. How long? Not long. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Yes, sir.
How long?
Not long.
Not long. Because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yes, sir.
He's trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. He's loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword.
Yes,
his truth is marching on.
Yes,
he has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat.
Yes,
he is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat.
Yes,
oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on.
Yes.
Glory, hallelujah.
Yes,
glory, hallelujah.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all name. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization. And they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us, so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors, because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization, and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve. And at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent. Leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped. shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diaspora, both objects of a global miasma that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that describes them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation. I shame. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation. I shame. Pour libation too to our children and those yet to be born, for they are the ones that you must teach, and you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe, ashe, asheo.
Welcome, family. Welcome, Hotep. This is your brother, Kwasi Shuja Kawatu Kram, your warrior for the people. We're back again on Blog Talk Radio, Warrior's Way, continuing the fight. I'll remind you that this is a call-in format. Our number is 516-418-5674. I repeat, 516-418-5674. Okay, again, Hotep family, celebrating the African woman, the power of faith over fear. I did have a number of people that were going to be on, but some communication issues, so we're just going to have to wing this, and that's fine. We've done that before, but I mean, we have a history of wonderful women, and for our ancestor sister profile, I'm going to be talking about Coretta Scott King. Okay, and so I'll start off with that. In 1974, King formed a coalition, and we're talking Coretta Scott King, of over 100 religious, labor, business, and civil and women's rights organizations dedicated to a national policy for full employment and equal economic opportunity. Now, she served as a co-chair on both the National Committee for Full Employment and the Full Employment of Action Council. Now, in 1983, she brought together more than 800 human rights organizations to form the Coalition of Co-Science, sponsors of the 20th anniversary of March on Washington. Now, during this march, the primary legislative focus was the passage of the King holiday. And in 1987, after Reverend Hosea Williams and a group of the marchers were attacked by white Klansmen and racist while leading a march through the all-white Forsyth County, Georgia, Mrs. King helped lead and organize a national mobilization against fear and imitation in the Forsyth County. Now, with the movement involvement, King Center, a multiracial commission, started working together to create a more open and inclusive community. Now, these efforts led to a racially diverse Forsyth County. Now, in 1988, she convened the Coalition of Co-Science for the 25th anniversary of the March on Washington. Now, in preparation for the Reagan-Gorbachev talks in 1988, she served as head of the U.S. delegation of women's for a meaningful summit in the Athens, Greece. And in 1990, as the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republic, USSR, was redefining itself, Mrs. King was the co-convener of the Soviet American Women's Summit in Washington, D.C. Coretta Scott King spoke at many history's massive peace and justice rallies. She served as a Women's Strike for Peace delegate to the 17 Nation Disarmament Conference in Geneva, Switzerland, and in 1962, she was the first woman to deliver the Class Day address at Harvard in 1968, and the first woman to preach in a statutory service at the St. Paul's Cathedral in London in 1969. Now, even prior to her husband's public stand against the Vietnam War in 1967, Mrs. King functioned as a liaison to peace and justice organizations. Now, Mrs. King tirelessly carried the message of nonviolence and the dream of the beloved community to almost every corner of the nation and globe. Now, she led goodwill missions to many countries in Africa, Latin America, Europe, and Asia. Now, she lent her support to pro-democratic movements worldwide and communicated with many world leaders, including Quezon Aquino and President of the Philippines in 1986 to 1982, Kenneth Kaunda, first president of Zimbabwe, and from 1924 to 2021, and Nelson Mandela. Now, she also met with many great spiritual leaders, including Pope John Paul and the Dalai Lama, Dorothy Day, Bishop Desmond Tutu. She witnessed the historical handshake between Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Chairman Yasser Arafat, and the signing of the Middle East Peace Accords. She was a strong advocate and a spokeswoman for the movement of abolish apartheid in South Africa, along with her daughter Bernice and her son Martin III. Now, Mrs. King was arrested for demonstrating in front of the South American Embassy in Washington, D.C., and after the fall of the apartheid, with the support of funding from the United States Department under Mrs. King's leadership, the King Center trained 300,000 new South African voters on the principles of nonviolence and preparations for the country's first multiracial election. Now, since she then stood with the president-elect Nelson Mandela in Johannesburg, when she became the South African's first democratically elected president, a woman of wisdom, compassion, and vision, Coretta Scott King worked to make ours a better world and in the process made history. Coretta Scott King tirelessly carried the message of nonviolence and the dream of the beloved community to almost every corner of our nation and our globe. Following Dr. King's death on April 4, 1968, Mrs. King acted upon her vision to preserve the places, writing speeches and sermons, as well as the works associated with Dr. King. Now, on June 26, 1968, Mrs. King founded the Martin Luther King Memorial Center and a nonprofit to serve as the official living memorial of the life and work of the legacy of her husband. In 1978, the Memorial Center changed the name of Martin Luther King Jr. for a nonviolent social change and commonly referred today as the King Center, and with the objective of providing programs and training in Dr. King's philosophy. So we're talking about Mrs. Coretta Scott King, and this is our ancestral profile, and many thanks to her and so many other great women, African women that have come of shoulders that we stand on that before, and we have many today that we can look to. You know, I want to bring up the Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and for everything that she's going through. But again, I know that she's thinking about all these women, Fannie Lou Hamer, just so many great women that we can just talk about that have come before us and have given us so much strength. And so just seeing that support. But the things that we're going through today, and the women have made such a path for us, and we need not to forget that and keep them in our prayers, and also to look back and learn of the works that were done so that we can learn from that and move forward, because so many times we think we have the answer. You know, we're fighting this fight. It seems to be an endless press by oppressors, but we are, you know, the biggest fight, I think, is fighting ourselves, because there's so much confusion in regards to what we should do and how we should do it. And is there a solution? I had a young lady, a dynamic young lady, on a couple weeks ago, Kenza Dawn, and she had made a point about it. We complain so much about, you know, the problems, but, you know, we're not talking so much about solutions. And is there a solution? And I believe that there are many solutions, but in order to do that and find those solutions, we need to learn who we are. And, you know, one of the things she talked about so much that really hit core to me was, you know, she was just talking about love, you know, having that love of self, knowing self. And if you don't know yourself, if you don't love yourself, I mean, it's hard to move on and work on anything else. If you don't know who you are, if you don't feel yourself, if you don't have that understanding and compassion, because I can tell you, from my life experiences growing up, I didn't always have a lot of compassion for people based on some certain things that were going on in my life. And so for that reason, I was a little rough around the ages. I mean, I was a young kid. I seen violence on the streets. I saw violence sometimes in my home. And how I responded, how I internalized that, you know, was a struggle. And like I said, as a young kid, I thought as a young kid, I didn't understand everything. But at some point, I found, you know, what my purpose was. I think I may have mentioned I witnessed a young kid when I was at school one day. It was a girl, and she was being picked on by some kids, and I made them stop, and I intervened, and her parents saw her crying, and I was, you know, trying to comfort the little girl, and they grabbed me, and the father started hitting me and ended up tearing my sweater, busted my nose, and then the little girl let them know that, no, he was helping, and they picked me up and dusted me off. And I remember when I got home, my parents, they looking at me like, oh, you got in trouble again at school, you know. But, you know, I kind of walked around with a badge of honor because, you know, I saved this little girl from being picked on. I also understood that her parents made a mistake. Like I said, they picked me up and dusted me off, and they were apologizing. And I understand how people can make mistakes. And we deal with so much of that in regards to people making mistakes and forgiving. And I'm not saying forget, but we can forgive. And so we have a lot of amazing women. I talk about my mother, for one. As my mother used to sing, and I was, her and my dad, my dad had a band, Horace Craft and the Night Shrinkers. And they played, and I found this out a couple weeks ago. My brother had did a show on Black Reality, same thing, Time for Awakening, on Doc Will Rogers' show. And I didn't know that my parents, you know, they would practice. They would, you know, play a lot of the stuff behind the OJs and the Temptations. And one of the reasons why they did that, because if for whatever reason they would go to the places they were going, and if where the Temptations or the OJs went, and if something happened where they couldn't perform, my parents, my father's band would perform. And so that was something that I found out then, because, and so now I understand why they always played their music, practice their music. And this was done in our basement back in the day on 16th Street. That's where we used to live. My father played the sax. My brother picked it up behind that. And my mother sang. And so I got to, you know, hear her sing quite a bit. I didn't pick up any music skills. I mean, I played a little precautions and so forth, but that was pretty much it. I'm hoping that I get one of my callers to come in. And if she does come in, she's going to share with us some of the journeys and stuff that she's been through. I've been blessed to meet a lot of dynamic women in my day. And one of the things, she's a business entrepreneur. She does African dance. She does a lot of stuff in the community. And I believe she has a dual citizenship here and in Africa. So if I get her in here, I'll let her, you know, share that information with you. And so we can, I'll let her, you know, inform you of her, the things that she does. You know, I watch so much of it on social media. But one of the other things I wanted to talk about now, and make sure I'm seeing her name, Katanji. Is it Katanji Brown Jackson's, her confirmation, and this is day four. And you know, for everything that, you know, how they're going after her, things of that nature, and it's pretty ugly, you know. And it's really something that, you know, she has all the credentials, but she's being attacked. But we had Cory Booker, Senator Booker, spoke on her behalf. And there were a lot of other people there, Democrats, that could have said something, but he made a statement and put out some information about her struggle and how well she's doing under these circumstances. And so I was very moved by that, as so many people, because he talked about her shedding a tear. And I don't think the tear was in that she was saddened by something, but she was just, it was an emotional 13 hours, days, where she's just being bombarded with questions. But she is very intelligent, and all of that come through in the conversations and how she handles everything. And so just going to kind of mention a little bit of talk about that. Like, and just on the third day of the hearings of Katanji Brown Jackson's confirmation to the Supreme Court came to a close Wednesday following another 10-plus hours filled with character smears about child pornography from Republican senators and phony umbrage about out-of-context quotes. And at this point, with just one more day of testimony from outside witnesses remaining, it is worth nothing that this entire circuit is being performed to try to pick off two of three Republican votes and perhaps one Democrat vote. Now, that will probably not come. One of the reasons Senator Lindsey Graham is quite literally spitting and screaming about briefs filed on behalf of Guantanamo Bay detainees and two decades ago is because having voted to confirm Jackson to a federal appeals court less than a year ago, he must manufacture sufficient umbrage to vote against her now. So he voted for her before, and now he's got to come up with something to vote against her. Now, happily for Graham this time, he gradually reduced him to a pile of free-floating umbrage held together by hair. Now, if we can all agree that the purpose of the charade of Graham is to try to flip Senator Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski, and that of Senator Ted Cruz's purpose to charade to goose his own Twitter mentions, and that of Senator Josh Hawley, the purpose to take what was a fringe endangering our children smear campaign last week, and the push into it of the GOP mainstream today is manifestly clear who the real pornographers are this week. But if we can all agree what the GOP agenda has been, I remain utterly mystified by the Democrats that they have the votes to confirm and they are about to alter the course of American history. So what are we afraid of? And so that's what you're getting with all these attacks on her. And she's handling and this well. And some of these questions that they're asking her is just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, you're looking for, okay, what is the point that you're making? Because they're asking her a lot of questions that she says she's not qualified to answer because that's not her role. And so she's made that known to them several times, but they keep going back to that, just trying to rock her. But we have a lot of powerful women that are esteemed, of course. So I did mention things about my mother and talk about a few other people. I happen to be working, and I want to talk about, you know, the strength of a woman. It's little, I think about a lot of the things from my grandparents. And, you know, when you talk about the strength of a woman, because, you know, and it's not saying that the man is out doing all this and that. The man does what he does and the woman does what she does. And no one is putting anyone ahead of the other. But it is, and I can't say for sure because I'm not a woman, but I do believe it is more difficult. My belief for a woman to navigate her way through all this oppression and difficulties that we seem to be facing. In my jobs, you know, I've worked law enforcement, I've worked community rec in a lot of different areas and stuff, so I've got to communicate with a lot of people, and they would share a lot of different stories with me. And in some of the stories that these women would share with me about their personal life, you know, the tragedies, and but yet still continue to move on. I can go on with my sister. She's has moved on. She's the ancestor now. She passed away several years ago, but she was one of those people that he's got three sons. They're all doing well. But she had difficulties in life, but, you know, she made sure that her sons were taken care of. She was a loving person, that soul that reached out to people and always had something good to say. She had troubles at different times because she was struggling with different types of abuse, with drugs, and which compromised her health, and to the point where, you know, she succumbed to, I believe it was a cancer, lung cancer, and that was at the age of 53, I believe. But she's no longer with us. But she was always a role model to me in so many different ways. You know, she was my younger sister by 2 years. But she was one that taught me how to fight. You know, she was a strong, a lot smaller than me. And I remember when we used to go to school. And so my brother's about a year and a half older than me. My sister, you know, like I said, she's 2 years younger. So we're all almost 2 years apart. And my sister is 5. I'm 7. My brother's almost 9. And we're walking to school. And my parents would say, make sure nothing happens to her. You know, and sometimes people would take our lunch money, this, that, or whatever. But we would make sure. I mean, we fought. You know, and they were bigger than us, but if they messed with my sister, that was a different story. We just did what we had to do to try to keep her safe. And for the most part, it was different. It was different. But we think about the things that are going on today. We just had a news bulletin the other night. We had a, what you call an Amber Alert, where some people took advantage of a young lady that was looking to help two girls. They claimed that they were being sex trafficked, and they wanted to get away from the people that were sex trafficking them. And this lady let the young lady stay in her apartment. And while she was in her apartment, she kind of laid down asleep, but she had a baby, 3 months old. And these young girls ended up taking that baby. Amber Alert came out sometime later. The lady found out the baby was missing when she woke up, called the police, and thankfully the police were able to locate the girl, and several people were arrested. And they did post a picture of a 15-year-old girl, and they indicated that she was part of the situation where this girl was when the baby was apprehended. And later on they revealed that that wasn't the case. But again, we're in a situation and we're living in a time where people seem not to have that care and concern. But here is the mother, and the news people left her. She wanted to remain anonymous. So they didn't show her face. They did, like I said, recover the baby, but she had made a comment. And she said, look, I'm just trying to help these people. These two girls came up to me and they asked if I could. They were being sex trafficked, and they wanted to get away from somebody. Can I stay here for a minute? We just need some place just to lay down for a minute. And she allowed them in. her home. So, you know, out of the goodness of her heart, you got people that are looking to always take advantage of them. And a lot of times those people look just like us. But that's part of what they use to allow them or take advantage of us. So we just have to, you know, have a different kind of understanding of what we need to do to protect ourselves first, you know, and really kind of examine the situation. You know, for one, if someone says that they are in this situation and they need help, and I understand you wanting to help them, but, you know, call the police. You know, you ended up calling them anyway after they took the girl. But, I mean, call the police and tell them, hey, I got some people here. They're worried. And they could most definitely find a place to take the young ladies if they were really in need and from getting away from somebody. You know, I mean, that's just the people that you want to call. I do understand a lot of times why people in the Black community do not call the police. But we, a lot of times, don't have so many options when we have a lot of people that aren't doing a lot of the right things, and that connection just isn't there. For what reason? I don't know. Is it people don't believe in God? You know, they're not God-fearing people. There could be a number of different things as to why, because we do end up dealing with people that claim that they're God-fearing people, but yet they do some of the most hideous things and murder, kill, rape, molest, and doing a number of different things. But, you know, so it's a very difficult situation, you know, to try to work these situations and deal with people that, you know, your intent is to help them. But, you know, it makes it very difficult, you know. I wanted to get my mother on this show to have her talk about, you know, her journey as a singer. She doesn't sing anymore. The last time she sung was in 1985 when I first got married. My first wife, Sherry Lee Hill was her name. We first met, and I'll just tell you a little bit something about my first wife and how she just did so many wonderful things in the community, but, you know, just through her struggles with, you know, her illness and how she just continued to be that beacon of strength for all of us and moving forward. And so I'm going to share this story. Me and my first wife, before we first met in the second grade, went to Keith Avenue. I used to tease her. I had a little crush on her. I used to pull her little piggy tails. You know, that's what we used to do when we liked somebody. Then later on, we met again in the sixth grade, went to Townsend, and somebody had beat her up and hit her in the stomach, made her cry. And I found out about it, and I beat that person up after school. And I liked her then, but, you know, I didn't say anything to her. I'm sixth grade now. We meet again in high school. My senior year, she went to Tech. I went to Washington, and we met at a football game. And we exchanged numbers and been communicating ever since. And so I never took my eyes off her from that day on. We married in 1985, November 29th, and we were blessed with two children, a son and a daughter. And in 1999, she found a lump in her side, and she went and got it checked out, and they told her that she had a cancer. And so she got treatment for it. And I had just started the business. I was a police officer. I got hired in 89. And just when I started the business, I started in school. She had got sick. So my school lasted for maybe about a year and a half. And then I had to let it go because, you know, her treatment was, it got pretty intense. And they believed that it was a slow-growing cancer, and they believe it started when she was in high school. But despite that, despite everything that was going through her, through everything she was going through, you know, she would get chemo treatments. She lost her hair several times. And she looked beautiful, bald. And she was very motivating to other people that were getting treatment, that were going through cancer. And she went through remission and so forth, seven different times. And on the eighth time, you know, that's when she had succumbed to from all the treatments and from cancer. But one of the things that the doctors used to do, they used to put her right next to some person that, a patient that just was very depressed, because she would always uplift everybody. When she was working at, she was volunteered at the schools, and she was the only person, African-American person over at the school where my daughter was attending. And so they thought she worked there because she was there so many times. But a lot of times, you know, my daughter was in high school and my son was in elementary still. But she tried to attend most of, you know, his events. And one of the things that she didn't do was she would not take a lot of the pain pills. I mean, she had it, but she would take it maybe at night, but she wouldn't take it all the time because she wanted to be able to see the kids when they performed at their events, whether it was a play, whether it was something athletics, but she wanted to be there and have a clear head and not be bothered by the medication, because sometimes it would make her sleepy and not be able to understand that the kids were talking to them. So she wanted to be able to also have a conversation with them, and she wanted them, so she would endure a lot of pain. And I remember many a times, you know, as she was going through a lot of the different issues with just weight loss and, you know, bone density, you know, where it got to the point where, you know, she couldn't walk real well. She just needed assistance, but she struggled. But she, you know, she pushed me away when I tried to get help. I mean, when I tried to help her, I mean, she wanted me, I can do this. And so I would move out the way, very strong-willed. But watching as her physical health declined, but her will and motivation did not move. She was just as strong as she ever was. And I know many a times, and people will tell you, you know, we would sit in a room a lot of times and watch TV. And, you know, it got to the point, you know, she would feel bad because, you know, like, as her conditioning got worse and her level of fitness and everything through the treatment and stuff, and we weren't able to engage with each other the way we did when we were younger and when she wasn't, you know, she felt bad about that. But, you know, one of the things that was my favorite things that she would make me smothered steak and mashed potatoes. And that was our sex. Smothered steak, mashed potatoes, and green peas. She would make that for me. And so that, I mean, that was just amazing. You know, we, you know, you make sacrifices And I know, I remember when we were young, we had made, and when I say young, we were newly married and stuff like that. And we said, you know, if one of us dies, this is what the other person is going to do, and we're not going to remarry, or we're going to remarry. We made these different, you know, promises here and there and stuff like that. But we kind of jokingly said that, not really thinking that it was going to really happen. You know, you just say those things, but then, you know, the reality of it hit. And so she wanted to prepare us all. My son was 10 years old when she passed. My daughter was 17, going on 17. And one of the things that people don't get, you know, when you live in a house with someone and they've, you know, the body starts to decline and they're not able to do certain things anymore, and just the frustrations and the things that they go through. And sometimes, you know, it's different because sometimes people just, you know, if they got high blood pressure, this, that, or whatever, and they can be fine, you know, for several years, but this one day, and then they have, you know, a heart attack, a stroke, a number of things can happen, and they're no longer, but physically they're still able and capable, and they look pretty normal. And in her case, that wasn't the case because, like I said, she lost quite a bit of weight. I think she was, you know, at in her last days, she might have been, you know, just under 90 pounds. But she wanted us to understand something, and she wanted her parents to understand something about me. She told her parents that, you know, when I'm not here, he's going to want to be with somebody else, and I don't want you guys to see anything. I want you guys to be in support. I remember one day we were leaving the hospital when I had my wife, and, you know, and I'm wheeling her out. And she points and she looks at this girl and she says, go talk to her. And I'm looking at her like, are you, you know, but, and she was serious, you know, but, and then we get in the car and she looks at me and, you know, are you crying? Is that, you know, I'm wiping. I mean, that's the kind of person she was. She was to the point, and she wanted things done a certain kind of way. She told me who she wanted, what kind of person she wanted me to be with, and I found that person. So I've honored her in that, you know, with my new wife I have now. And, you know, I know that my kids, my son and my daughter, are better off from all the things that they went through with their mother. And as a family, how we just were able to cry in our own different ways. And, you know, a lot of times people tell you, you know, I remember when we went to the funeral and my son, you know, people kept, come on, let it out, let it out, let it out. They kept telling them, I'm like, his mother has been going through this for several years, and she prepared all of us for her final days and how, on what she wanted us to do. And we followed those instructions, and we cried so many different times on so many different ways. And so many people want to try to define how you should grieve. And, you know, so we went through a number of different things trying to let people know, hey, we're good. We're good, you know, but people, like, a lot of times they don't want to believe you or take your words. But I guess my point is I was married to a remarkable woman that had a lot of power, that influenced a lot of people and made things better for pretty much everyone she met. And she was like a very positive, strong person. So when I think, you know, of celebrating strong African women, you know, and faith over fear, I mean, you know, my wife many a time, she's like, I'm going to beat this. I mean, that's just how she felt. And, you know, and we would go places, you know, watch my daughter compete in track and field events. And I know she would be in pain sitting on the bench because it was just too hard, even though we had the little cushions and stuff. And then the same thing when we were going to church. It got to the point where, you know, her bones were so fragile, you know, because they could break so easy that we had to quit going to church. But, you know, when my kids were competing or doing something, like I said, she didn't want to take the pills that would reduce the pain. You know, so she was such a strong-minded, strong-willed person that just set an example for us all. And so I really, you know, I think about that daily, you know, because, you know, even though she's not here, you know, I'm like, you know, I know you're looking down and, you know, you're happy, but, you know, our kids are doing well. And, you know, we don't forget. We don't forget. Like I said, we have a lot of wonderful, wonderful women that like to celebrate. I talked about, you know, my mother a little bit, trying to get her, like, on the show one day. She's a little shy about doing something like that, having this discussion. But one day, maybe we'll have that. You know, I had a young lady on the show, and I mentioned a while back, a couple weeks ago, and she had mentioned something that I see so much where, you know, women are so over-sexualized. You know, you always see them in swimsuits or, you know, they try to promote them a certain way. And I remember Nicki Minaj, she was saying, when she was younger, before she started the music, when she was starting the music business, and, you know, guys were always talking about, you know, what they liked and this and that. And that's one of the reasons why she said she went and got the implants, and, you know, because she wanted to be attractive to what the men wanted. You know, it was a business move, so to speak. But, you know, you have so many of these women, you know, despite what she did there, you know, she had to be talented. She able to be able to market herself. And so, you know, so many times we look at people and we think of their, you know, they made it because they're pretty, because no, they were able to navigate themselves, put themselves in a position where they could be seen, where they could be heard, and they knew what people liked. But they were smart enough, diligent enough to stay on course and stay focused, because there's so many people that don't make it. You know, one thing that I found out about Rihanna, she's, I don't know if she's a billionaire, but she's close to it if she's not a billionaire. You know, she owns her own clothing line. You know, she's a singer. She's been in movies, but this woman has a high IQ. She's 140. Her IQ is 140. But you don't hear people talk about that. You hear people talk about, you know, how beautiful she is, you know, how well she looks dressed, being pregnant, and, you know, the physical stuff they put out there all the time on us. You know, but these women are so magnificent and, you know, able to be able to market themselves. Think of Beyonce, you know. I mean, same thing. And in order to be able to perform and do the things that they do and be able to market themselves is a wonder. And then bringing up these other people behind them, you know, so that follow in their footsteps. You know, so I think there was a Janet Jackson before her. And same thing, you know, a talented family. But, you know, it's always more difficult, I believe, for women. So it's like they have a different gear that they can put in or switch that they can pull. that's going to help them get over and endure. You know, as men, I know that easier for us just because of being a man. I mean, this is a man-made world, so to speak. And so, you know, men for the most part, and a lot of us look down on our women. I had a young man, a good friend of mine, talk to me earlier today, and he made mention of something. And I said, we should have a show and talk about it. But one of the things that he mentioned is he was wondering about how men seem to not have this relationship. It's like we're moving in a different relationship. We're getting into a different area where we no longer want to be associated with women anymore. And then I said, you know, that's a conversation that we need to have, but we really need to have this group conversation. And I guess he was made some mention about that for the simple fact that, you know, you have these different movements of transgender men or women, and correct me if I'm wrong on some of the different terminologies that they use in regards to what you call a lesbian or gay, or, you know, I think lesbian for women and gay for men. But point is, there's a lot of different things that are going on, and he kind of brought that up. And I said, yeah, we can have that discussion one day, but we really have to get people in that are, you know, qualified, you know, some psychiatrists, but we also have to have some people that live that lifestyle that would be willing to talk and just share with us why or, you know, they're why they do what they do, why they feel a certain kind of way. I mean, there's always something, you know, like people tell you, you know, this is just how I've always felt. I always felt different some kind of way. And I know that's true for all of us in so many ways. And so we have so many different ways of expressing that. So, like I said, that's a conversation that we can have. I've been trying to set something up like that. And I think the first week in April, I'm looking to do something like that. I may do it a Zoom conversation. I have a couple of psychiatrists lined up to talk about it. Because some people look at it as genocide, you know, because, you know, you can't man on man, you can't produce a child, or woman on woman, you can't produce a child. So, but they've, you know, found other ways where you can, you know, get a sperm from a male and put it inside of a female, and, you know, or, and that, you know, so there's a number of different ways. But, and those are a lot of things that are going on today. And so those are issues that we'll probably talk about. But again, I'm not that scientist or biological person that can, you know, talk specifically on why. But it is an interesting conversation, I believe. So I'm going to look forward to that and have some, most definitely some qualified people talk about that, because I did bring that up many a times, but like I said, a lot of people, they didn't have a problem talking about it, but they certainly didn't want to talk about it on the airwaves. And I said, sometimes you might, because conversation earlier, about this. And the only reason I'm kind of talking about this is I was hoping that one of the young ladies that I called, if she comes on, but if she doesn't, I'll just kind of continue. But when you look at a lot of people that have gender identification issues, and one of the things that you don't want to do is make that person feel bad for feeling a certain kind of way, where it goes to the point where they feel that they can't, they're not being accepted as to who they believe that they are, and then they harm themselves or commit suicide, something to that effect. And so we have to, you know, really be mindful of what we say and how we express these situations to people with our concerns. So that's one of the things that, like I said, I want to try to have that conversation and get some people that know more about that to me. And so we're going to take our first break, and we will be back in a few minutes. And you are on Warrior's Way, continuing the fight.
Listening to Warriors Way Radio, where their motto is continuing the fight. Your host is Brother Kwasi Kraft. Warriors Way Radio is an affiliate of the Sankofa Historical Society, which is a part of the Black Reality Think Tank, and they are operating on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Check them out. Email them at warriorsway101@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com, go to the search portal, put in the Sankofa Historical Society, and check out any of our programs that are there. They air every Thursday evening, 6 o'clock, Warriors Way Radio, continuing the fight.
Tired of not being heard? If so, follow Black Sister Talk on Instagram and send us a DM with your thoughts, or become a patron by going over to Patreon and adding Black Sister Talk. For my people that don't do social media, reach out to us at our email, blacksistertalk@gmail.com.
All right, family, we are back. And I did get a call, but it was during the break that we had, and so I'll see if they call back. But again, I don't know if this hearings or confirmation of Kedenji Brown Jackson judge, Kedenji Brown Jackson, if that's still going on today. I don't know how many days that is, but, you know, but she's handling herself and doing a magnificent job. I'm going to just kind of continue to talk about some of our sisters that are in the movement. I mentioned Fannie Lou Hamer and, you know, some things that I don't know how well people know her, but she was Fannie Lou Hamer, Townsend Hamer. She rose up from humble beginnings in the Mississippi Delta to become one of the most important, passionate, and powerful voices of the civil voting rights movement and a leader in the efforts of greater economic opportunities for African Americans. Now, Fannie Lou Hamer was born October 6, 1917 in Montgomery County, Mississippi, the 20th. And she was the last child of sharecroppers, Lou Ella and James Townsend. Now, she grew up in poverty. And at the age of 6, Hamer joined her family picking cotton. And by the age of 12, she left school to work. In 1944, she married Perry Hamer. The couple toiled on the Mississippi plantation owned by B.D. Morrow until 1962, and because Hamer was the only worker who could read and write, she also served as a plantation timekeeper. And in 1961, Hamer received a hysterectomy by a white doctor without her consent. Without her consent, while undergoing surgery to remove a uterine tumor, such forced sterilization of black women as a way to reduce the black population was so widespread that it was dubbed a Mississippi appendectomy. Oh, I might have killed that word, appendectomy. Unable to have children on their own, the Hamers adopted 2 daughters. The summer, Hamer attended a meeting led by civil rights activist James Foreman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the SNCC, and James Bevel in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. Hamer was incensed by the efforts to deny blacks the right to vote, and she became the SNCC organizer and on August 31st, 1962, led 17 volunteers to register to vote at the Indianola, Mississippi courthouse. Now, denied the right to vote due to the unfair literacy test, the group was harassed on the way home when police stopped her on the bus and fined them $100 and for trumped up charges and the bus too yellow. That night, Merle fired Hamer for her attempt to vote. Her husband was required to stay until the harvest. Marlowe confessed it. Much of their poverty, and that Hamer's move to Ruleville, Mississippi, in Sunflower County with very little. And in June of 1963, after successfully completing a voter registration program in Charleston, South Carolina, Hamer and several other black women were arrested for sitting in a whites-only bus station restaurant in Winona, Mississippi. In Winona jailhouse, she and several of the women were brutally beaten, leaving Hamer with lifelong injuries from a blood clot in her eye, kidney, damage and leg damage. In 1964, Hamer's national reputation soared, and she co-founded the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which challenged the local Democrats' party efforts to block black participation. Now, Hamer, other MFDP members went to Democratic National Convention that year, arguing to be recognized as the official delegation. Now, when Hamer spoke for the Credentials Committee, calling that the mandatory integrated state delegates, President Lyndon Johnson held a televised conference, so she would not get any television airtime. But her speech with its poignant descriptions of racial prejudice in the South was televised later. And by 1968, Hamer's vision of racial parity in delegations had become a reality. Hamer was a member of the Mississippi's first integrated delegation. In 1964, Hamer helped organize the Freedom Summer, which brought hundreds of college students, black and white, to help with African-American voter registration in the segregated South in 1964. She announced her candidacy for the Mississippi House of Representatives, but was barred from the ballot. A year later, Hamer, Victoria Gray, and Annie Devine became the first black women to on the U.S. Congress when they unsuccessfully protested the Mississippi House election in 1964. She also traveled extensively giving powerful speeches on behalf of the civil rights. In 1971, Hamer helped to found the National Women's Political Caucus. Now, frustrated by the political process, Hamer turned to economics as a strategy for greater racial equality. And in 1968, she began a pig bank. Now, to provide free pigs for black farmers to breed, raise, and slaughter. A year later, she launched the Freedom Farm Cooperative, the FFC, buying up land that blacks could own and farm collectively. Now, with that assistance of donors, including farmers, singer Harry Belafonte, she also purchased 640 acres and launched a coop of stores, boutiques, and sewing enterprises. She single-handedly ensured that 200 units of low-income housing were built. Many still exist in Ruralville today, and the FFC lasted until the mid-1970s, and as the heyday, it was among the largest employers of Sunflower County. Extensive travel and fundraising took Hamer away from the day-to-day operations, as did her failing health, and the FFC hobbled along until it folded. And not long after, in 1977, Hamer died of breast cancer at the age of 59. And so when we talk about these women, and a lot of times we say that, and these are the shoulders of great people that we stand on. And so when you look at the work that she did, and I believe and she spoke to people, hundreds of thousands of people, or millions of people, televised and so forth. But here's a woman that I believe she only had a sixth grade education, but then, she was educated in so many ways of the world and understood what needed to be done. And so you saw that she was organizing so many of these different groups. She understood, from the farming, from sharecropping, and just so many other struggles from her own parents and just seeing what was going on around her. She had a vision, and she worked at getting these organizations, raising this money again, so much, and she became so popular. And like I had mentioned earlier, Harry Belafonte had donated some money so that she could purchase 640 acres. You know, so we have we stand on the shoulders of a lot of great people. And so a lot of times we sit here and we think that, you know, we need to do something different. And I think that we're doing a lot of the right things, but we just don't have a lot of, we're just not in control of where things grow. We don't, where things go. We don't own a lot. We don't own anything here, basically. There are different places, different countries. You know, if I buy some land in another country, and I'm just going to say Africa because I know that from some of the people that I spoke with, and they own their land. And they don't pay taxes on this land. This is the land that they own. We buy land here, and we can say pay for this house, but we still have to pay taxes on this land. And if we, for whatever reason, aren't able to pay taxes, we can lose everything. And so we really don't own this. And so, you know, so this is a difficult situation when you live in a situation where you really don't own things. You don't produce. We're more consumers than anything else, so we have to find a way to build our own village within a village to be our own. And so when you look around and you see this with a lot of these other communities, and when I say, I'm just going to break it down, I'll break it down like this. Let's say you take a Jewish community. Let's say you take the Arab community, the Asian community. You know, they pretty much live together, their businesses, you walk in there and it's just them. It's nothing wrong with that because it's a family business, but this is what they do. You may have a person here and there that may not look like them, that may be working there to some degree, but for the most part, it is them. They speak their language, and we don't have any of that for the most part. You know, I meet a lot of people that Hispanic, and you know, and they'll talk to me in English, and then they'll talk to their other people in a different language. I don't know too many people that are of that are African that speak so many different languages here in the United States that I meet on a regular basis that grew up, and so there is a difference, a distinct difference in stuff, and so I think because we operate on different wavelengths like this, you know, there's just confusion with a lot of the things that we try to do because there's not a clear message. There's not a clear-cut message as far as what we need to do. And so with Coretta Scott King, with the work she wanted to do to carry on from what her husband did, but there are so many things that she did young, way before even her husband and after, and so many things that so many of these women do, but they are just not acknowledged so much, and so much so. Why is that? You know, because this is a male-orientated type of thing, you know, and we need to look at things from a different perspective, and we need to hear their voices. And I don't want to be that person, so to speak, that say these things because, like I said, it should be a woman speaking. I did have some people, but, you know, those communication issues changed, so you're hearing my voice. But if I... to get a call from one of my, I mentioned someone that I was hoping that they was going to call because, like I said, they do a lot of community work. And one of the things that they do, and they work with men and women. And when I do say this, and when, you know, we talk about Women's Month, I mean, you can't have a woman without a man and vice versa and so forth. But, you know, where does the man come from? He comes from the women, you know. And so we all have that passageway, you know, where that relationship that we travel, this is where we come out of. And so it's important that we keep that engagement, that relationship, and understand, you know, that each one needs one and each one needs to teach one. And we're so, I think, distracted and confused as to who we are. You know, there's a division as to, is there a Christ? Is there, who do we serve? Who do we worship? You know, is there a God? Why are these things happening? You know, so there's much that we need to discuss. And there's just so many people. I'm just going to talk a little bit more about some of our past ancestors. And I'm going to go with Ella Josephine Baker. Now, she was an African-American civil rights and human rights activist. And she was largely behind the scenes organizer whose career spanned more than five decades in the New York City and the South. She worked alongside some of the most noted civil rights leaders in the 20th century, including W.E.B. Du Bois. Okay. Now, Ella Josephine Baker, she was born December 13th, 1903, December. And she went to Ancestry in December of 1986, and she was an African-American civil rights and human rights activist. She was largely behind the scenes organizer whose career spans for more than five decades in New York and in the South, and she worked alongside some of the most noted civil rights leaders in the 20th century, including W.E.B. Du Bois, Thurman Good Marshall, A. Philip Randolph, and Martin Luther King Jr. Now, she also mentored many emerging activists such as Diane Nash, Stokely Carmichael, and Bob Moses, and as leaders in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Baker was criticized and professionalized charismatic leadership. Now, she promoted grassroots organizations, radical democracy, and the ability to the oppressed to understand their words, their worlds, and advocate for themselves. Now, she realized the vision most fully in the 1960s as the primary advisor of the strategist of the NCC, biographer Barbara Raspe calls Baker one of the most important African-American leaders of the 20th century, perhaps the most influential woman in the civil rights movement. Now, she is known for her critiques of both racism in America and the cultural and sexism in the civil rights movements. Now, Ella Josephine Baker was born December 13th in Norfolk, Virginia, to Georgiana Blake and Blake Baker. And the first raised there, she was the second of three surviving children. She bracketed by her older brother Blake Curtis and younger sister Maggie. Her father worked on a steamship that sailed out of Norfolk and was so often away. Now, her mother took in boarders to earn extra money, and in 1910, in Norfolk had a race riot, which the whites attacked black workers from the shipyard. Her mother decided to take her to Carolina, where their father continued to work for the steamship company. Now, Ella was 7 when they returned her to her mother's rural home near Littleton, North Carolina. And as a child, Baker grew up with little influence. Her grandfather, Mitchell, had died, and her father's parents lived a day rides away. She often listened to her grandmother, Josephine Elizabeth Bette Ross, tell stories about slavery and leaving the South to escape its oppressed society. Now, at an early age, Baker gained a sense of social injustice, and as she listened to her grandmother's horror stories of life as an enslaved person, her grandmother was beaten, whipped for refusing to marry an enslaved man her owner chose. Now, and she told Ella and other stories of life as an African-American woman during this period. Giving her granddaughter the context of the African-American experience helped Baker understand the injustices black people still face. Now, Baker worked as an editorial assistant as the Negro National News in 1930 for George Schuessler, a black journalist, and later an arch conservative, founded the Young Negroes Cooperative League, the YNCL. Now, it sought to develop the black economic power through collective networks, and they conducted conferences and training in the 1930s in their attempts to create a small interlocking system of cooperative economic societies throughout the U.S. for black economic development. Having befriended Schuller, Baker joined his group in 1931 and soon became the national director. Baker also worked on the Workers' Education Project. The Workers' Project Progress Administration, established under President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the New Deal, and Baker taught courses in consumer education, labor history, and African-American history. She immersed herself in the culture of political millennium of Harlem. And in the 1930s, protesting Italy's invasion of Ethiopia and supporting the campaign to free the Scottsboro defendants in Alabama, she also founded Negro History Club at the Harlem Library and regularly attended lectures and meetings at the YMCA. Okay, I have a caller on my line. And let me see. Caller at 1552. Caller 1552. Questions, comments? Okay, the call was dropped. Okay. Baker befriended, time Baker lived and married her college sweetheart, T.J., which is Bob Roberts. They divorced in 1958, and Baker rarely discussed her private life or marital status. According to fellow activists Bernice Johnson Reagan and many women in the civil rights movement followed Baker's example, adopting a practice this disassembled balance about their private lives that allowed them to be accepted as individuals in the movement. Now, Baker's befriended John Henry Clark, a future scholar and activist, Paul Murray, a future writer, a civil rights lawyer, and others who became lifelong friends. Now, the Harlem Renaissance influenced her thoughts and teachings. Now, she advocated widespread local action as a means of social change. Her emphasis on grassroots approach to struggles of equal rights and influenced the growth of success of the civil rights movement in the 20th century. Now, in 1938, Baker began her long association, National Association of the Advancement of Colored People, and then based in the New York City in December of 1940, she started to work as a secretary. know, she traveled widely on the organization, especially in the South, recruiting members, raising money, organizing local chapters, and she was named the director's branches in 1943 and became the NAACP's highest-ranking woman, outspoken woman. Baker believed Tarian ideals. She pushed the NAACP to decentralize its leadership structure and to aid its membership in more than activist campaigns at the local level. Now, Baker believed that the strength of the organization grew from the bottom up and not the top down. Now, she believed that the branches work was at the NAACP's lifeblood. Baker dispensed elitism and placed her confidence in many. She believed that the bedrock of any social change organization is not the leader's eloquence of credentials, but the commitment and hard work of the rank and the file membership and the willingness and the ability to engage discussion, debate, and decision-making. She especially stressed the importance of young people and women in organization. In 1946, Baker took her niece, Jackie, whose mother was unable to care for her. Due to her new responsibilities, Baker left her full-time position with the NAACP and began to serve as a volunteer. Now, she soon joined the NAACP's New York branch to work on local school desegregation and police brutality issues. Now, she began as president in 1952, and in the role she supervised the secretaries and coordinated the national office's work with local groups. Now, Baker's top priority was to lessen the organization's bureaucracy and give women more power in the organization, this including reducing Walter Francis White's dominating role as executive secretary. Now, Baker believed the program should primarily channeled not through White and the national office, but through the people in the field. She believed she lobbied to reduce the rigid hierarchy place of more power in the hands of capable local leaders and give local branches greater responsibility and autonomy. In 1953, she resigned from the presidency to run for the New York City Council on the Liberal Party ticket, but was unsuccessful. Now, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1957 and 1960 in January, Baker went on to Atlanta to attend the conference aimed at developing a new regional organization to build on the success of Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama. Now, after a second conference in February, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, she was formed. This was planned as a loosely structured coalition of church-based leaders who were engaged in civil rights struggles across the South. Now, the group wanted to emphasize the use of nonviolent actions to bring about social progress and radical justice for Southern blacks. Now, they intended to rely on existing black churches as the heart of their communities, as a base of its support. Now, its strength would be built on the political activities of local church affiliates. Now, the SCLC leaders envisioned themselves as the political arms of the black church. The SCL first appeared publicly as an organization in 1957 at Prayer Privilege for Freedom. Baker was one of the three major organizers of this large-scale event. She demonstrated her ability to straddle organization lines, ignoring and minimizing rivalries and battles. The conference first projected was the first was 1958 Crusade of Citizenship, a voter registration campaign to increase the number of registered African-American voters for the 1958 and 1960 elections. Baker was hired as an associate director for the first staff for the SCLC, and Reverend John Tilley became the first executive director. Now, Baker worked closely with Southern civil rights activists in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, and gained the respect for her organizing abilities. She helped initiate voter registration campaigns and identity other than local grievances. The strategy included education, sermons in the churches, and the efforts to establish grassroots centers to stress the importance of vote. They also planned to rely on civil rights, the Act of 1957, to protect the local voters. While in the project did not achieve its immediate goals, it laid groundwork for the strengthening local activist centers to build a mass movement for the vote. Until he resigned as director of the SCLC, Baker lived and worked in Atlanta for 2.5 years as an intern executive director until Reverend Wyatt T. Walker started in the role in April of 1960. Now, Baker's job with the SCLC was more than frustrating than truthful. She was unsettled politically, physically, and emotionally. She had no solid allies in the office. Now, historical Thomas F. Jackson notes that Baker criticized the organization for pragmatic sluggishness and King's distance from the people. Now, King was an orator then in the Democratic Crusade, she concluded. And that same year, 1960, we're talking the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, on the heels of the registration desegregation sit-ins led by black college students, Baker persuaded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to invite Southern University students to the Southside Youth Leadership Conference at Saul University on Easter weekend. Now, this was a gathering sit-in. The leaders met, assessed their struggles, and explored the possibilities of future actions. And at these meetings, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was formed. Now, Baker saw the potential for a special type of leadership by the sit-in leaders, and who were not prominent in the movement, she believed, but they could revitalize the Black Freedom Movement and take it in a new direction. Baker wanted to bring the sit-in and participants together in a way that would sustain the momentum of their actions, teach them the skills necessary to provide the resources that were needed, and also help them to coalesce into a more militant and democratic force. Now, to this end, she warned the activists to be wary of leader-centered orientation. Now, Julian Bond later described the speech as an eye-opener and probably the best of the conference. Now, she didn't say, don't let Martin Luther King tell you what to do, Bond remembers, but you got to do the real feelings. That was what she meant. The SNCC became, this is what she said, but you got to do the real feelings. That's what she meant. SNCC became the most active organization in the deeply oppressed Mississippi Delta. It was more open to women, than other prominent civil rights organizations, including the SCLC, where Baker witnessed extensive misogynistic teachings and the suppression of women activists. But widespread sexism, appeals to male supremacy, pervaded his membership. After the conference, Shaw Baker resigned from SCLC and began a long and close relationship with SNCC. Along with Howard Zinn, she was one of SNCC's highly reverend adult advisors, known as the godmother, of SNCC. In 1961, Baker persuaded the SNCC to form two wings, one wing for the direct action and the second wing for voter registration. Now, with Baker's help, SNCC, along with the Congress of Racial Equality Corps, coordinated the region-wide Freedom Riders of 1961. Now, they also expanded the grassroots movement along with black shell croppers, tenant farmers, and others throughout the South. Now, Ella Baker insisted that strong people didn't need strong leaders and criticized the notion of a single charismatic leader or movement of social change, and keeping the ideal of Baker wanted involved. Now, she also argued that people under the heel, the most oppressed members of the community, had to be the one to decide the action that we were going to take to get out under the oppression, and which makes a lot of sense. Now, she also was a teacher and a mentor to young people in SNCC, influenced such important future leaders as Julian Bond, Diane Nash, Stokely Carmichael, and Curtis Muhammad, Bob Moses, and Bernice Johnson Reagan. Now, through SNCC, Baker's ideals of group-centered leadership, and the need for a racial, democratic, social change, the spread throughout the students' movement of the 1960s, for instance. Now, the Students' Democratic Society, the major anti-war group of the day, promoted participatory democracy. And the ideals also influenced a wide range of radical and progressive groups that would formed the 1960s and 1970s. In 1964, Baker helped organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, the MFDP, as an alternative to the all-white Mississippi Democratic Party. Now, she also worked as a coordinator of the Washington office of the MFDP and also accompanied the delegation of the MFDP to the 1964 National Democratic Party Convention in Atlanta City in New Jersey. Now, the group wanted to challenge the National Party to affirm the rights of African Americans to participate in a party election in the South, where they were still largely disfranchised. Now, when the MFDP delegates challenged the pro-segregationist all-white official delegation, a major conflict ensued. The MFDP delegates was not seated, but their influence on the Democratic Party later helped to elect many black leaders in Mississippi. Now, they forced the rules to change to allow women and minorities to sit as delegates in the Democratic National Convention. Now, so when we talk about people, and I mentioned Ella Baker. She was born Ella Josephine Baker in North Fork, Virginia, and she died December 13, 1986, at the age of 83. Her occupation, she was an activist. She was and she was in a lot of different organizations, like the NAACP, SCLC and SNCC, and she was married. Her spouse, T.J. Bob Roberts, that was from 1938, married and divorced in 1958. But again, you know, her early activism efforts and the work that she did, you know, this is one of the women's shoulders that we stand on, one of our great ancestors. So I'm just appreciative to, you know, read up on her and know the movement and the things that were done and how she led and motivated people. You know, I think about today's movements because I've been involved in a lot of different protests throughout the Milwaukee area. And one of the things that she was talking about, you know, she was like, the people that are being oppressed, you know, you need to hear their voices and they need to be the ones making the decisions. And so many times, you know, the people that are making the decisions, you know, aren't the people that are being oppressed. Those are the people that are oppressing us, but they're making decisions for us. And we then, you know, they give us a number of options, and then we decide which of the two options are best. Kind of like this last presidential election, you had to choose between Biden and Trump. And I don't think those were two good choices, but those were the choices that we had. And so many times, that's what we're dealing with. We don't get a lot of good choices. And then also in the conversation, she talked about, you know, the sexism and the male-dominated, orientated type of thinking where a lot of times they didn't listen to the women. And you can see that, you know, in her struggles and the work that she's done and organizing so many different committees and moving forward, that she was a powerful force. And so many times, you know, we're dealing with that. Like today I talked about the judge that's trying to get confirmation, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and for everything that she's going through, but she is doing just under all of this pressure, just a fantastic job, just, you know, for this, trying to get these folks. And I believe, and I'm not a politician, but I believe we have enough to get her confirmed, but just everything that's going on is just very interesting because it's been more than 30 hours. But this Ketanji Brown Jackson, you know, she would be the first. She would be the first black woman on the Supreme Court. And so this is where we are. So, and I'm just going to talk just a little bit about this. Like it talks about, it says on Thursday, just hours after the hearings came to close, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell announced he will vote against Jackson's confirmation. He also said in a floor speech that he cannot and will not support her for a lifetime appointment. McConnell slammed the liberal groups that have supported Jackson, and he criticized her for refusing to take a position on the side of the 9-member court, even though the decision is ultimately up to the Congress. Some advocacy groups have pushed for enlarging the court after 3 justices nominated by former President Donald J. Trump cemented a 6-3 conservative majority. Now, McConnell also cited concerns about her sentencing criminals, defendants, and a subject that dominated much of 4 days of hearings, and that was of a coordinated GOP effort to portray her as soft on crime, which she is totally not, and that has been demonstrated throughout her career, but they You know, one of the things that they've been doing is they've been, if you repeat something enough, and they understand it, and that's always been their strategy, that people will start to believe it. And this is why they keep repeating things over again. It doesn't make a difference. And they have proven this to not be true. But the strategy is if you keep seeing it, and people look at the faces that are seeing it, you know, they're thinking that they know something that we don't know, so it must be true. But again, it's not about being true. That's just a strategy by them just keep repeating it over and over and over again. And so, and that's the strategy that they're using. And it's, you know, it's pretty sickening. But I kind of also cited, like I said, concerns about her being soft on crime. Now, his position was expected and does not affect Jackson's trajectory to be confirmed by mid-April. But the leader's declaration could prompt many of his fellow Republicans to follow suit. Thorpe seen Biden's efforts to bring back the overwhelming bipartisan votes that were commonplace for Supreme Court nominees when the first came to the Senate 5 decades ago. Now, I think whoever I pick will get a vote from the Republican side. Biden said after Justice Stephen Breyer announced that he would step down from the court this summer. And as he started to search for a replacement, the president made a point in inviting Republican senators to the White House to hear their advice. And so, you know, that's the path to the Supreme Court confirmation. And so this judge, Ketanji Brown Jackson, is really going through a lot, but she's, I believe, doing a magnificent job, and she's getting support from so many people. And just listening to her talk, I mean, she's such a dynamic woman. Okay, we're going to conclude our program for tonight. I didn't get my guest, but that's okay. We'll be prepared for our next outing. In the program that I'm looking to do is in April, I'm going to talk about, want to talk about, and I have a few people on board, Dr. Kwaku and Dr. Watson, both are clinical psychiatrists. And looking to get a couple more people on. And so that's going to be on the 7th, I believe that is, of April. And we're going to talk about gender identification issues. And so we're, and why that seems to be such a problem and the laws behind it, how we address people, whether it be our own family members, employees, this, that, or whatever. I mean, you just have such a different number of issues. I mean, there was just an issue where a transgender person won a Division I swimming championship. And then there's some issues with that with some of the people. And there's some people that there's some yays and some nays and, you know, and I mean, just your viewpoint on this. And I mean, or should there be a different division? I mean, since it's a difference in, you know, between a male and a female in regards to capability, so to speak. I mean, not that a woman can't be better than some men, but there is a significant difference in some areas. And we just have to be realistic about that, and you know that's just the way it is. So let's just have that discussion, and so we're looking to set that up in April. Okay, this is your brother Kwasi Kraft, Shuja Kwatu, your warrior for the people. We will see you next time on Warrior's Way. You can contact me via Gmail at warriorsway101@gmail.com. Remember, this is the call-in format at 516-418-5674. And these programs are archived, and you can put them on the search portal on blogtalkradio.com, Warriors Way, continuing the fight, or you can go to Zankofa Historical Society. And again, look up our programs. All right. Thank you. Hotep.
When the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, Lord.
Woman and child, even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. No one can win the war individually. It takes the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory. The coming of the Lord, my eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes,